from the Paul Blart Mall Cop 2 studios in Los Angeles. It's time to go back to the films. Now here's your host, Tommy T.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening to this special installment of Back to the Films, a podcast dedicated to the reminiscence and appreciation of films of old. I am your host, Tommy T. Or actually, my real name is Thomas Sampson, a.k.a. Tommy T. I'm the writer, creator, host of Back to the Films, the world's greatest film podcast, or I believe to be the world's greatest film podcast. And today I'm being joined by Forrest Hartman. He is a lecturer in journalism at California State University, Chico. He was a lecturer in English and journalism at the University of Nevada, Reno, which is my school. He is a Tomato Meter's approved critic on Rotten Tomatoes, and who has over 500 published film reviews, many of them for the Reno Gazette Journal here in Reno. And if you have seen other episodes of Back to the Films, you'll know right away this is a considerably different format from normal episodes. And you might be wondering, why am I speaking with Forrest today? And along with him being a very interesting and nice guy, Forrest is a film critic, and I have aspirations of one day becoming a film critic myself. So along with getting to know Forrest a little better, I could learn some tricks of the trade, and I figured why not record our Zoom call so that everyone can learn more about Forrest and the tricks of the trade as well. So before we get started, I'd like to thank Forrest for speaking with me today, and although I already gave introduction, it was a very brief introduction. I only mentioned a few of his many accolades in his career, and I'll go ahead and hand it off to you. Just introduce yourself, your education, your history as a film critic and professor, other fields of work you like to mention, et cetera.
All right. Well, I won't go too in depth because you did a nice job there, Thomas. So thank you. I graduated from CSU Chico in 1990 with a degree in information and communication studies. And as you noted, I am a lecturer in journalism at that school now. So it's sort of nice to be teaching at my alma mater. I worked for most of my career as a professional journalist, as you noted, not only as a film critic, but primarily as an entertainment writer. Although if we go way back to the start of my journalism career, I did everything from sports to business. So I'm a pretty broad-based journalist. And in fact, my education, I said my degree was in information and communication studies. When I went to Chico State as an undergrad, that was the only option we had. We didn't have a specific journalism degree as we do in the program now, but you could get a communications degree with an emphasis in journalism, which is what I did. So I have a pretty traditional journalism education, even though my degree doesn't say journalism, it says information and communication studies. I took basically the same sorts of classes that we're teaching now. Of course, drastically updated because, you know, now we're dealing with multimedia and all the things that didn't even really exist when I was getting into the career. But the basics of how to be a good reporter was there. And during the course of my career, I worked for a number of traditional newspapers. I started out at my in the newspaper business at my hometown paper, the Oroville Mercury Register. I worked for the Chico Enterprise Record, which is a local paper around here. And then the heart of my career, I went to the Peel Democrat in Marysville, Yuba City area, worked there for 3 years, and then spent, I lose track, I think it was 12 years at the Reno Gazette Journal in Reno. And that's also when I got into education. When I was working in Reno, I started teaching part-time, as you noted, at the University of Nevada. Very fond memories there, so it's nice to be talking to a member of the Wolf Pack. So thanks for having me on your show. That sort of gave me my taste into teaching. My wife and I moved back to California my wife in late 2012 and me in early 2013 as I had to sell our house and things like that. And then I was fortunate enough to get a job teaching at Chico State, where I'm very happy to be. Through all of that, I have continued to produce film reviews and things like that. I don't do as much in the writing, or I do broadcast reviews as well. I don't do as much reviewing now as I did before I was a full-time professor. But I still keep my hand in it and still try to, you know, crank out reviews as I have time for them, as sort of a secondary job. I mean, to be honest, it's almost a bit more of a hobby for me at this point. I mean, I make some money at it, but most of my living now is as a lecturer in journalism. And that's probably more background than your listeners want, but there it is. That's my career in a nutshell.
No, that was great. Thank you. As you can see, I wanted to leave the introduction to you mainly because you have done many things in your career, and I knew that I would not be able to cover it all. So thank you. And so the first question that I'll have is, it's kind of a very endearing question. It's almost like a question that you would be asked at like take your parents to school day or something like that. But it's like sometimes these endearing questions are the best. And what is your favorite thing about being a film critic, or perhaps, if you feel more appropriate, an entertainment writer in general?
Well, those are two different questions, I would say, so I'll answer both of them. So my favorite thing about being an entertainment writer is really just getting to interact with creative people and see things that I would not be able to see if I wasn't an entertainment writer. And I get to do a lot less of that these days than when I was a full-time journalist for a newspaper. You know, when that's what I did every day, I would meet new people, or at least people virtually every day. And very often they were artists that I respected, musicians, actors, singers, you name it. I would meet really fascinating people, get to have discussions with them. And as most people listening probably know, that's not something that you just get to do on a daily basis, say if you're a plumber or a carpenter or something like that. And I don't say that to diminish those careers at all. They're just different careers, right? You're doing different mm-hmm. things. And just being able to interact with creative people and learn from them and meet those people, I found very fascinating. So as an entertainment writer, I think that's what I enjoyed the most, the interactions with people. And really, that's what I enjoy most about being a reporter in general, even if it's not entertainment. You get to meet so many fascinating people. You get to do so many fascinating things, because to properly report, you need to get out and experience what's going on and witness it. And it's just a constant learning process, which I love. Now, my favorite part of being a film critic is, what can I say? I just love movies. I think you really have to love movies to do this as a job, because I don't know how many movies I've watched in my lifetime, but I've watched a lot of great ones and I've watched a lot of terrible ones. And to make it through the terrible ones, I think you have to have a love for the genre overall. You know, you have to be able to say, well, you know what, there's going to be the next great one out there somewhere, and that's what I'm waiting for. And you have to really love it. So the fact that for many years, you know, that I got to watch movies and then not only watch them, but give my opinion on them and be paid for it. What more could you ask for?
Yeah, for sure. Like, that was definitely one of the things that my mom said, was like, if you're going to be a film critic, you have to keep in mind you're watching all the movies. You don't just get to pick and choose what you want to talk about. And it's like, I put myself to the test a little bit there. And like, I put myself, I think it was in 2018, I watched a lot of movies and I was like, I'm watching it all. I'm watching them all. I'm putting myself to the test. Can I handle this? And I found myself enjoying the bad movies and the mediocre movies and being able to take some out of all of them. So I was like, I think I could do this, Mom. So, and I hope I can, hopefully achieve a certain status where I can hopefully interview some pretty great filmmakers and actors as well. So that would be another perk of just, in a sense, watching movies for a living and talking about them. So
yeah, stick with it. And when you're doing that, I mean, if being a film critic is your sole career, what you're talking about is more important than ever. I'm fortunately in a position now where I mean, educator is my primary career, So I do get to pick and choose a little bit more than someone who is only making their living as a film critic would get to do. Although I still watch bad movies, right? If something's really, these days I tend to focus on what I consider to be either the most interesting projects or the most important. And if something is critically important and turns out to be bad, well, that, you know, I still watch it. But I will skip a lot of the sort of what I would consider to be minor releases, particularly if I have no interest in them. But that is certainly something that having another number one job has allowed me to do, right? If you're just a film critic, you don't usually get to do that. You review virtually everything, or at least everything that your outlet has an interest in.
Yeah, for sure. And so... as you were saying, you know, it's more of a hobby for you now to be reviewing films than it is an actual job. I'm not entirely sure if you have actually reviewed movies that have came out this year. Either way, what is your favorite movie of 2020 so far that you have seen?
Well, I've actually probably done more film reviews this year than over the last few years, in part because of the pandemic has kept us all home a lot. So I've actually had a lot more time home with the family and watched a lot of films, and I've sort of ramped up my reviews this year. My number one film, though, is one that I haven't written a review of yet, and it's been out for a while on Netflix. I don't know if I'll actually write one or not, but it's The Trial of the Chicago 7. Which I think is just a brilliant film. I just watched it the other night, so it's interesting that that became number one. I've seen a number of very good films this year as well. The documentary film that Ron Howard did about the campfire in Paradise, California, which is very close to where I live now, Rebuilding Paradise, I think is a great film. And so I've seen a lot of good things, but that Trial of the Chicago 7 is my number one of the year right now.
Great. I'll definitely check it out, and I definitely recommend anyone listening to check it out. Let me quickly check. I forgot to check. Like, I don't think I've seen anything that's come out this year. I've been very busy.
There's actually some very, very good stuff out there this year.
I was looking at my Letterboxd and sure enough, I have not rated anything from 2020. I definitely need to start watching movies as soon as I can.
It's been a strange year, though, too, because, I mean, as you know, most movie houses shut down very early in the year, where really the best material that had been released into theaters were, you know, Oscar contenders from the year before. Because January through March typically is not a big time to release new noteworthy films. So some of my favorite things are things that might not normally have ended up there. Like I said, Rebuilding Paradise, Trial of the Chicago 7. I really liked Disney Plus's Hamilton, where they squished together a whole bunch of actual Hamilton performances and made them a movie. There's a great film on Amazon Prime called 7500 with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. So there's a lot of great stuff out there, and a lot of it actually appearing on streaming platforms. And it seems that, you know, now that HBO has announced that Wonder Woman 1984 is going straight to streaming, it'll be curious to see if that's the future.
Yeah, for sure. And now that I remember, like, I can't believe that I forgot. I just forgot to log it on the website, but I did watch Borat 2. One movie that I've seen, so.
Yeah, and again, on Amazon Prime, right? Yeah. I mean, if fascinating, a movie you would think would normally get a theatrical release, but went straight to Amazon Prime.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting to be like, yeah, this movie is brand new, but I'm watching at home. It's just... something I need to get used to. So I think we all need to get used to. And okay, so this would be more for people. This is like general tips and tricks for people who are interested in getting into film criticism like myself. And great question in general to start off with. It was something I had trouble figuring out for a while. Is like, what is the number one degree or field of study that you recommend aspiring film critics to roll in?
Well, you know, I will give you an answer, but probably not necessarily the best answer. And the reason that I say that is you and I have talked about this personally. It's very difficult to become just a film critic today, right? In part because the way media is. When I was entering the newspaper industry, it was probably the end of the last great era of film critics. And what I mean is you had Roger Ebert's, and when I was growing up, you had a guy by the name of Joe Baltic, who has sadly passed away, but was a guy I really admired, who was a film critic at the Sacramento Bee. And most major papers had film critics, people that just made their living that way. And over the last 20 years or so, we have seen it get to the point where very few major news organizations have somebody who is employed solely as a film critic. You do still have some, like the New York Times, you know, very, very big publications that have decided that's important, but not very many. I belong to a group called the Broadcast Film Critics Association. Some of the members in that group are allowed to be primarily film critics, but most, even at the big outlets, are more than just critics. Like Sam Rubin is a member for KTLA in Los Angeles. And as far as I don't get to see his work very often, but the last I saw Sam Rubin, he was not just a film critic for KTLA. He was their entertainment guy. So even some really big market people are not just reviewing films, right? They're expected to do really broad-based work. So from that standpoint, my suggestion is to get a journalism degree. And I don't just say that because I'm a journalism professor. I say that because it's very difficult just to go out and be a film critic. So if your goal is to be a reporter who covers film, I think having that broad-based journalism background is going to be helpful to you because it's going to teach you to do a lot of things and to get a media job, right? And if you're particularly interested in broadcasting, maybe your focus should be on broadcast journalism. If you're more interested in internet, maybe you should be more focused on print. Although these days, everything's really sort of crunching together, right? I say the more versatile you are, the better, and that's been the case in my career. I've been on radio, I've done podcasts like this, I've been on television, and it all sort of works together because the internet, what is the internet these days? Is it a radio station or a TV station or a print publication? It's really all of those things. And the best outlets use video and audio and print together. So I say having a broad-based media journalism background is probably best if your sole goal is to, excuse me, be a reporter and work in media. Now, if you are interested in being a film critic and maybe doing something else as your primary job, just like I can still review films, there's a lot of routes you could go, right? Like a film degree is not going to be a bad path to take. It's going to teach you a lot about film. You're certainly going to be able to critique films. There's a longtime friend of mine who actually was an intern for me at the Reno Gazette Journal years ago, who's got a film degree, who has a great film podcast and is a really wonderful film journalist, I would say. But again, that's not his primary education. His primary education is as a high school teacher. So it depends on what you're looking to do. If you're going to do it part-time, I'd say you want to learn as much about film as possible. If you want to be a full-time journalist who writes about film, then I'd go the journalism route.
Yeah, that's definitely great advice for me. Like, it wouldn't have necessarily made a difference, but yeah, it's actually not readily available advice because I remember going into changing my major to wanting to become a film critic. Like I thought it would be English, if anything, because it would be, you know, I just assumed to be writing film reviews. And it's like, well, no, not necessarily. I mean, it's like you can either broadcast reviews or film your reviews and upload them on the internet. And yeah, it's like journalism is great in that way because it's so versatile, and it, like the more well-rounded you are, if anything comes up, then like I said, it's like the major publications, even the biggest ones, are getting rid of their film critics, or they're only becoming part-time film critics. So yeah, if you are like me and you're an aspiring film critic, definitely become as versatile as you can. If your school, if your local schools offer, or any universities considering, they're offering film degrees, definitely consider those. But if not, like the University of Nevada, Reno does not offer a film major. They have the cinema media studies minor now. They just recently introduced, and I just happened to change at like the perfect time for that. So unless they have a film major, you're probably best bet going to be journalism, right? I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. And you mentioned English. I didn't put this in my background. I've got a ton of graduate credits in English from the University of Nevada, and I don't actually have a graduate degree, which is rare for a college educator, but it's where I am. But I have a ton of graduate credits from the English department at University of Nevada. I would recommend English for people looking to be English teachers, for people looking to be creative writers, for people to working in the book publishing field, for people who just want to be good writers. So certainly you could come from an English department and become a film critic and potentially become a film critic for writing. But English programs tend to focus more on people going into publishing, people becoming creative writers, people, sometimes becoming creative nonfiction writers. But journalism programs tend to be really career-based and produce graduates looking to go out and work directly in the media, which is, English, if you go into book publishing, is media as well. But I find journalism programs to be more specifically media-based, looking to produce people that would be doing what you're talking about. And these days, there's a lot of crossover. I mean, obviously, if you're writing film reviews, being a great writer and being able to analyze texts or visual texts, those are qualities that you need. And you can gain those skills in both journalism programs and English programs. What the journalism programs typically give you that the English programs won't is a real focus on media, right? When I was taking English classes, all great classes, great professors there in the Department of English at UNR, but we talked extensively about rhetoric and writing and analyzing texts and things along that lines, which is all critically important for a film critic. But what we didn't talk about much was working for a newspaper or working for a television station or producing videos and things like that, which most journalism programs that are good these days will focus on. And those are critical skills you need if you plan to go work in the media.
Yeah, definitely. It's not a one size fit all answer for sure. It's definitely a case by case basis. Figure out what else you would like to do alongside being a film critic, and definitely go from there and consider your options and what's being offered for you. So the next question, and is another general tips and tricks for kind of introductory, but it's also useful for people that are already are in quite a bit. Like, what are the three biggest helpful tips that you can give to aspiring film critics?
Oh boy. I mean, that's tough. I mean, number one would be learn as much as you can about film and film history. And I say that because I think you get a lot of people that want to be film critics, but haven't watched anything but a movie that's come out in the past 10 years. And I think that gives you a very narrow view of film, and it makes it very difficult for you to, when analyzing remakes or really any movie, speak to its place in film history. And film has been around for well over 100 years now. So it helps to at least have some idea where film has been and how it's progressed. The other tip is to stay current, I think, you know, unless your goal is specifically to be a reviewer of classic movies or something like that. And there are some very good people that focus specifically on, you know, one genre or one, you know, era or something like that. And obviously your goals play into this. But if your goal is just to be a general interest film critic, I think staying current is important. I think learning as much as you can about film is important. And then probably the third trick would be just to refine your skill set for whatever medium you're working in is. If your goal is primarily to be broadcast, then constantly be working to be a better broadcaster, right? If your primary outlet is print or writing or, you know, internet, keep working on that writing, right? Because that's what draws people in. I mean, the first thing that you're going to lose credibility in your reviews if you aren't a really good writer. And today in a web-based environment, we have a lot fewer checks than we used to have. And what I mean by that is very often what you produce as a writer is what goes up on a website. You know, if you're lucky, you have one good editor that looks at it, but you're not always lucky. You know, sometimes you're in a scenario where you're the last set of eyes. And those are environments where it's really easy to make mistakes. I've made tons, and I've been doing this a long time. So the better you are, the cleaner your copy is, the better an editor you are, the better you're going to be. And the same thing's true with broadcasting, right? There's, I've done a fair amount of broadcasting, but I'm not nearly the expert that some of the people I've worked with that have primarily been broadcast journalists are. And there's so many things you can do to just be better with your presentation. So I would say those things, right? You know, study film, stay current, and then work on, you know, your media skills for whatever your primary delivery system is. And if you do all those things, if you're lucky enough to do what I've done in my career, to be both a print producer of reviews and a broadcast producer, work on all those things, get better at all of them, because that's, you know, ultimately what's going to make you successful.
Yeah, that's great advice, definitely. And I think you bring up a good point too about there's not a lot of editors these days. So, and all it takes is it's a very fidgety fan base that we're dealing with here. They're very critical. They are the critics themselves, realistically, the people reading you. So, and all it takes is one typo or one incorrect name. And it's like, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. It's like, well, we are human. So, I mean.
Yeah, I'll always remember I reviewed one of the first Transformers films, and I got confused about who were the Autobots and who were the Decepticons or something because I was not a Transformers guy growing up, and so I was processing what I saw in the film and reviewing it as a guy who was not a big Transformers fan. And of course I immediately got hammered on that, and you know, people argued that I had no credibility because I didn't know what an Autobot was, and it was fair criticism, right? I knew how I made the mistake, but they weren't wrong, right? I had missed that part of the film. So and you're right, and people latch onto that very quickly.
Yeah, so I am currently at it's been a while. Like, I unfortunately been very busy with school and haven't been able to watch. Like I said, I've only watched Borat 2. That's the only 2020 movie I've seen. I think I saw about maybe 10 movies from 2019. So I'm definitely looking forward to watching movies. But so I've kind of not been watching a lot of movies lately, but I've rated over 800 of them. And I've written reviews for about 50 of them. And one thing that I've always dealt with, like, certain people wouldn't be as big of a deal but for me it was the rating system. Like I would always end up in a predicament where it's like, this movie's a 6 but this movie's a 7, but it's like, oh, they have to be the same, or it's like, you know, it's always this, like, for me, since I'm not publishing them, I can edit my rating for them, unlike, you know, someone like you where it's like you kind of have to stick with your rating. I mean, you could change your opinion, but it's like, well, I can't necessarily go back and change, you know, my publication for that. So I was just wondering, like, it's just a fun question in general for people who rate movies, Describe your rating system that you use. Do you use out of 4 stars, 5 stars, out of 10? Why do you prefer it over others? Have you changed it over your career, your approach in rating movies in general? Has it changed or stayed the same?
It has changed, and actually the system I use is probably not the system I prefer. So let's talk about that. Probably my preferred system would be out of 10, because I sort of like the range, and I think there's like probably a big difference between a 6.5 star or a 6.5 out of 8 and a 3.5 and a 3. And when you condense it down to 4 stars, you lose a lot of those nuances. So I think 10, like they do on like the Internet Movie Database, is a pretty nice scale. You can see if it's got a 5.7 or a 9, and you're like, oh, okay, that's a pretty big swing. Whereas when you condense it down to 4 stars, it's tougher. That said, I use 4 stars. Why? Just at some point in my career, it may have even been an editor that convinced me to do it. I found that most of the people in the print journalism world were using 4 stars. I think I had started using 5 stars sort of to get myself a little closer to that 10 scale. Like, okay, well, that one extra star is helpful. Let me have more nuance. But most people out there were running 4 stars, and I would appear sometimes alongside Wire reviews and things like that. And just for the sake of consistency, I'm trying to remember, I may even have the story wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was an editor that talked to me and were like, hey, most people are using 4 stars. Let's be consistent. It'll be easier that way. And I said, sure, and I've just stuck with it because it's what I've been using for so long. Do I think it's perfect? No. I mean, I think the 10 stars or 0 to 10 is probably a better system. That said, a lot of people still use 4. And what 4 makes you do, I think, is that is beneficial is write better reviews, right? Because 3.5 to 3 stars doesn't seem like that much difference, but in my mind, sometimes they are. Like a 3.5 star movie is a near perfect movie that, has some missteps. A 3-star movie can be anywhere from, okay, to, almost not a recommendation. Like I tend to, my recommendation tier tends to be 2.5 to 3 stars. If I give it 3 stars, I'm usually saying, yeah, it's worth seeing, not necessarily going to make your all-time great list, but I don't think you'll be bummed out if you drop $10 to see it at the theater. And I feel that way about some 2.5-star movies. They're usually sillier. They usually have poorer execution, but sometimes I'm like, I'll give a 2.5-star movie or 2.5 stars to a movie that's like, that's entertaining for what it is. It's not great. I'm not going to rush back and see it again, but it's not bad. 3.5 and 4-star movies are usually up in my range of like, these are must sees. And so if you just look at the ratings, I don't think you'll get all the nuance. How I say they make you write better reviews is I think all that nuance needs to be in the review, right? Since there's not a lot of separation between 2.5 and 3 stars, but I do consider there being a difference there. I got to get all that into the review. I've got to explain, you're probably going to like it if you like X. You're probably going to hate it if you like X. And all that detail has to come out in the review.
Yeah, I could definitely see what you mean. Like the less ratings, like the less nuance that you have for your rating system, the more detailed you have to be with your review to distinguish that difference for sure. And I think that's what happens with a lot of people. It just comes down to just the popular trends. For you, it was your editor telling you this, like, let's just do 4 stars because all these other film critics are doing 4 stars, even though you wanted that extra star. And that may not seem like a big deal for normal people, but if you have, for people who do rate movies, they know that extra star makes a huge difference. And it's just, that's like one of the hardest parts sometimes is like, what do I rate this,
Sure. And the consistency, in the publication, I think my editor was ultimately right, right? If we're going to run reviews by me and 2 or 3 other people, all of us having the same system that we're rating with is helpful for the reader, right? Because if they see a three-star movie from me out of five and a three-star movie from somebody else out of four, they're distinctly different things. So at least when we were all using the same scale, you know, it was a little more meaningful to readers, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely something that I am currently using out of 10 system. I have changed it a lot. I've used like the almost like a 20-point system where it was like 6, 6.5, 7. But like IMDb, they allow you to rate 1 out of 10, but they don't allow the 0.5s. And after a while, I started forgetting like the little differences, and I was like, I'll just round up. And, you know, if it's right, 6.5, I round up to a 7. So kind of the same case with me, because it wasn't an option, I was forced to change my rating system. So
you're listening to Back to the Films. Follow me on Twitter at Back to the Films P for updates on future episode and other wacky shenanigans. And check out my new website at backtothefilmsp.wordpress.com. And without further ado, let's get back to the titillating action.
So yeah, that's definitely just a fun random question that I had personally. And the next one is, let's see. Oh yeah, this is a great one. So many films, as you'll know personally for sure, many films are accompanied with lots of hype, expectations, and passionate fans. Just think Star Wars, for example. Literally any Star Wars film is going to fit this description. So as a film critic, do you ever feel any added pressure in rating a film with a lot of hype around it? And if so, what do you do to mediate that added pressure?
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned Star Wars, and I'm wearing a Star Wars shirt, so it shows I'm a fan, right? So I don't worry too much about hype, to be honest. What I've worried about more over the years, I guess it depends on how you define hype. I don't worry too much about the marketing machines surrounding films. I mean, some movies are wildly hyped just because there's a lot of money behind them. And expectations from fans are high. I tend not to worry about that stuff, right? I mean, I can't divorce myself from it. If a film's being massively hyped, it's being massively hyped. Mm-hmm. But I tend not to be like, oh, I got to give this a great review that they had a multi-million dollar advertising campaign that went with it. I don't really worry about that. Where I have struggled more often in my career is coming to a film maybe a few days or a week late or something, and I've seen that the entire critical community besides me has savaged a film or has given it wonderful reviews and thought it was the greatest thing ever. Then you feel like your credibility is on the line. Like, man, if I'm the only one who loves this film and everybody else hates it, am I going to just look like an idiot? Or, you know, or vice versa, right? Geez, everybody else loved this film. I hated it. They're going to think I'm an idiot. My credibility's gone down the line. And I try when I'm writing not to let that impact me either. I mean, I've had relatively well-known situations where I've been the odd man out. I still kind of like Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor film, even though, you know, everybody hated it. I think it's sort of a sweet, you know, retro war film. And I don't love all Michael Bay stuff. I just, that was sort of my take on that film. And certainly I'm the odd man out. And I've had other things. Mulholland Drive, when it first came out, I think I got to give that one another shot, but I did not like that movie. And everybody else, David Lynch, oh, it's the greatest thing ever. So, I mean, I just wrote the reviews, but I probably struggled with those. I didn't struggle as much with Pearl Harbor because my review on that was a day one review. Nobody else had written about it. I struggled more on Mulholland Drive because I didn't love it. And it was an art film, and it came to Reno after it had been playing in a number of other markets for weeks. So I knew the critical consensus on that was, oh, it's another masterpiece. And I'm like, yeah, I don't see it as a masterpiece. So I've struggled more in situations like that where I have a feeling for the critical consensus out there, and I am not part of that critical consensus. And I think it's just self-doubt, right? You start going, well, you know, I think I'm good at this. I think my opinions are valuable, but at the same time, I disagree with all these folks. What's wrong with me? You know? And I think it's like any self-doubt that's in your mind, you got to put it, you just got to like keep them down there. And you have to remember that opinions are opinions, right? And I have seen people write scathing indictments over the James Cameron's Titanic, which was one of the best-selling films of all time. And I've seen people write love letters to it. And they're all smart people, and they all make good points. So I just sort of, I try to put the self-doubts, push them down, and just remember that the key to writing a good review or to producing a good broadcast review is to defend your point of view, right? If you have an opinion and you can defend that opinion with detailed examples as to why you feel the way you do, that's all that's really needed. I mean, there will always be people who agree with you. There will always be people who disagree with you. The key thing is to, you know, not just express an opinion, but defend that opinion, right? With detailed examples from the film. And if you can do that, you know, you're not going to convince everybody you're right all the time, but at least you can say that you have produced a quality and thoughtful review.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was, it's something that I've wondered if film critics have felt that way, but it's something entirely different for a film critic like yourself to admit, be like, yeah, it's, it has an effect on you. And it's interesting for you. It affects you more when you see the rating beforehand, like if you don't get to watch the movie for a couple of days or weeks, and then be like, oh, okay, it's like, I don't want to go against the grain here. For me, it was always something like, I wonder how a film critic feels going in cold, like being one of the first people to review a movie. And it's like, you have no bases to go off of. So it's like, you might love a movie, and then you might be the only film critic that loved that movie, or vice versa. So it's interesting that for you, it's actually the other way around. When the reviews are already out, that's when the most pressure is on, in a sense, you know?
Sure. Yeah, there is some pressure on things. And I think film critics would do well to admit and remember, too, that the environment in which you watch a film plays a role. You don't want it to, right? But film criticism is a personal thing. It's an emotional thing, because we're human beings. So if you watch a film and are particularly tired or in a bad mood or something like that, that can impact how you feel about it. And I try to take that into account, but it's difficult. I can't tell you how many films I've had to review when I was just absolutely exhausted. And I didn't really have a choice. This was more so in the days when I was doing this for a living, and I was doing other journalism. And it was like, man, the only time I can watch this film is now at 11 o'clock at night, and I got to crank out a review tomorrow. And it's like, I don't have any other choice, right? If I'm going to write it, this is what I got to watch it. And I'm dead tired, and I'm drinking coffee. And that sort of thing affects it. I also remember when I saw Snakes on a Plane, which was not a great film, but it was pretty hyped up, and it was a noteworthy film. I think I screened it at midnight with a full theater in Reno. I think it was a Century Plum Lane. That movie house is still there, right? I think. So I wrote sort of about the experience, because it wasn't a great film, but it was a really fun experience. People in the crowd were cheering and throwing model planes and snakes and stuff. And that factored into it, right? Had I been watching that movie at home alone on video, it probably, I would have been like, man, this is terrible. But watching it in that environment was almost like a Rocky Horror Picture Show thing. And in that review, I actually wrote a little about the environment and noted that, hey, this would probably be a different experience watching it with a different crowd. And that's one of the things about, I think, all journalism. Transparency is key, right? Honesty is key. Great writing, great criticism, just requires detail. And I think that's the main thing. You want to be transparent with your audience and offer as much detail for your opinions as possible.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that we've discussed in multiple journalism classes is it's really impossible to be objective. We are human, and we do have biases and stuff like that. And one of the things that could definitely affect your experience of a movie is the situation, the environment that you watched it in. And that actually leads perfectly into the next question of there's a lot that accompanies the cinematic experience that is lacking from watching a film at home. That includes seeing the film on the big screen, the booming sound of the surround sound system, the buzzing atmosphere of watching with others, and just the general excitement of it feeling like an event. Because for many of us, going to the theaters is an event. It's not something that we do very often. And this might result, this lack of that experience, it might result in a film critic viewing a film in a lesser light than they would have if they had watched that same film in theaters. And it's a very unique contemporary obstacle that modern film critics have to deal with. And I was just wondering if you would have any advice for them to, like, how do you handle this obstacle of having, in a sense, a lesser experience, but trying to make that adjustment to be like, what would I think if I had seen this in the big screen?
Yeah, I mean, that's very tough to adjust for, and it's a great question because it's something you may not really have even ever thought about unless you're a film critic. Now, I've watched films in a lot of different ways, and this includes, you know, the pandemic is unique in that more studios than ever are just simply sending me screening links and apps and stuff that, like, I can watch a ton of stuff now on, I have an Apple TV. So once I get signed in, it's kind of a pain in the butt because I got to, you know, sign in with passwords every time because they're so strict about their content, but I understand that. I understand why they do it. So now I can watch tons of stuff, just like fire up that Apple TV. And once I get through the password process, just watch it on my TV, which is great. Because I never have to leave the house. But pre-pandemic, it was still sort of the same thing. When I was in Reno reviewing movies, and I think if I get my dates right, I left the Reno Gazette Journal in late 2010. So, you know, we were talking like 2000, 2010, that era. I watched films on DVD. I watched films in theaters, either alone or with maybe four or five other film critics, or, you know, sometimes I would bring my, often I'd bring my wife along if that was allowed. Sometimes studios would say you can bring a guest. Sometimes they'd say you can't bring a guest. So I've watched movies every way from on DVD at home to sitting in a theater alone. To Reno was unique in that, you know, we would get art house films, but often much later than other films. So oftentimes what I would do is I would go down to Sacramento for a critics screening of a big movie. And sometimes those critic screenings would be with packed theaters. They would invite film critics, but they would also pack the house with giveaway tickets. And then throughout the day, before going to that big movie screening, I would catch two or three art house films that I could then write reviews about. So I guess what I'm saying is I had the opportunity when working in Reno, at least, to see films as everybody else would in theaters with audiences. Sometimes as nobody else would on DVD at home or in a theater alone. And all of those experiences are completely different. And as we talked about in the last one, that certainly can impact how you feel. All I did was, I tried to do the best that I could. And I try to focus on what's on the screen and remember that that's what's really important. And that, really you're writing reviews, I would say, for your audience. And you have no idea how they're going to be watching the film, right? They may be seeing it in a packed theater. They may be seeing it in a, on a Sunday afternoon when not many people went out. So as much as possible, I try to focus on what's on the screen, think about that, block out all of those extra influences. But as I said, and when we were talking about the last question, you do your best to block them out, but it's impossible to entirely block them out. And if I felt like something, sometimes I'd get a situation too where I'm watching a film and it was like a really crappy print, like it was really scratchy, just not a good quality copy of the film. If it was something like that, I would try to keep that in mind. I would try to assess how much the lack of quality of the print was giving me a negative experience, you know, and just focus on the rest of the film and say, well, would I have felt as negatively about this film if it had been a pristine print? Probably no. And I'll adjust the review a little bit to that. But there is no perfect answer to that question, right? It's just, I think being honest with yourself and trying to, you know, present the best version of your truth. And with film criticism, it's all subjective. But there's a guy, Carl Bernstein, you probably know, and one of the famous Watergate reporters said that basically journalism is trying to produce the best obtainable version of the truth. And he worded it that way because sometimes you don't always have the full truth. Well, in a review, you're trying to give the best obtainable version of your truth, your subjective. And that's what I always tried to do, right? I may go back to Mulholland Drive, which I mentioned next week, and think, man, that's one of the best films ever made, and I panned it. But that wasn't how I felt when I wrote the review. So that's, you know, all you can go with is what you're feeling at the time, and do the best that you can.
Yeah, 100%. Like, he definitely, it's interesting because as someone who is an aspiring film critic like me, I've only seen a handful of movies in theaters. And that was one of the perks of wanting to be a film critic was, hey, I get to actually go to the theater more than once or twice a year. And, but yeah, there's been cases where when I first got into movies, I would watch them as DVDs because it was just cheaper than the Blu-rays. But then as I got more into movies, I was like, I kind of wish I watched the Blu-ray of that. Maybe I would have liked that movie a little more, especially if it's like a special, you know, like a movie with a lot of special effects. And yeah, it's definitely like the best film critics, they just block out all those distractions for sure. It's like, not every, you know, it ranges even more, like the difference between watching a movie on DVD versus Blu-ray is even much more dramatic when you consider that theater experience, watching in an empty theater versus in a packed theater, 100%.
Well, and that's why I've watched films in a theater alone. Like, everybody would be like, why the hell would that happen? Well, it's because the studio had made the judgment that we don't want the critic watching this at home on a DVD, right? They could have sent me a DVD or something like that. But they're like, we want the critic to have this theatrical experience. And it's so important. We'll rent out a theater to show them the movie under that conditions. And so they're taking that into account. And there was never any, you know, I'm an independent critic, so never any agreement that I'm going to give it a better review because of this or anything. It's just like, no, that's the way we want to show you the film, right? That's like, we won't send you a DVD, not because we don't trust you, but because we think this is the way this film's supposed to be experienced.
Yeah, it would be like Christopher Nolan not wanting you to watch Interstellar. I had a DVD at home. It's like, no, this is a theater experience. And it's like, I refuse to allow you to watch it as a DVD. Right. And it's definitely a case if the studios go through that much effort to literally rent out an entire theater just for a single critic, just how significant a film's rating really is and how much of an effect it has on how many people or how few people go watch it in theaters. And I think it's a case that, you know, in the most crazy circumstances, like a movie being released on demand at home versus in theaters, it could make the difference between it being fresh or rotten. If it just happens to be like either, you know, that kind of borderline movie for a lot of film critics, and if it just makes that slight difference for it to be rotten, I mean, it could make a big difference in a movie's success. And it's definitely an interesting thing to consider.
Sure.
And this definitely leads to the other question very well, too, because this is something that I've heard referenced a lot of times, but like never really found a concrete answer. And I've heard cases of people just full-blown getting a copy of a movie between, you know, a couple of weeks, if not a full month before it was released in theaters. And it's not like a case of not, you know, it's a complete film. I mean, it's not like you're watching Avengers, but without, you know, the special effect. I mean, it is the complete version of the film. So how can film critics, as far as I know, you get in good with the film studios, to get this, right? To get this privilege to watch the movie early. So how can film critics get in good with the film studios to watch films prior to their theatrical releases? And also, it's interesting because it's like, that would be a huge advantage to be able to watch the newest Marvel movie a week or a month before everyone else, because it's like, wow, I could just publish my review on YouTube, and if someone wants to see a review on it, I have no competition. I'm literally the only one, you know, that knows, who has seen the movie and has reviewed it. But you don't, I don't see that happening. So there must be some limitations. So do these film studios prevent them from publishing the reviews until the movie's released, or how does that work?
Well, you know, with the First Amendment, there's really no way for a studio to prevent you from running a review early. However, they almost always have what are called embargoes if they allow you to see a movie early, which means, you know, they demand that you do not run a review prior to X date that they have set. You know, if I break that embargo, am I going to end up in jail? Well, no. What's going to happen is the film studio might not work with me the next time I need to see a film early. So the embargoes are enforced basically with like, hey, we're doing you a favor. We know you need to see this film early to do your job. So we're going to provide that to you. We recognize that, you know, your work is important to us. We provide things that are important to your work. Let's just have this gentle person's, or in my case, gentleman's agreement that, you know, we're going to show it to you and you're not going to run your review prior to this X date. And sort of you getting the film early is an agreement to that. I have had situations where I accidentally broke an embargo, not very often, but I remember one case. I wrote a review when I was in Reno that often my reviews would go out nationally on the Gannett News Service wire, which Gannett News Service doesn't exist anymore, but it did when I was there. And one of, I think the wire service even put my review out with the embargo on it. But, you know, we would watch films and then write them and they'd be out early because, with newspapers who Gannett News Service largely served, you can't just, you know, the review doesn't appear magically. You have to prep the paper and print it and things like that. And anyway, I remember one paper, I forget which one, either didn't see the embargo or ignored it and ran a review earlier. And I got a call from the studio and I apologized and said, hey, I wrote this for the wire service. I don't really have any control over that. I will call the wire service and let them know that you're concerned, and I'm really sorry, but I did not do this intentionally. And they were pretty cool about it, right? It was one of the only times it ever happened in my career, and they're like, yeah, okay. And it was also only a day or two early, and they just wrote it off as a mistake, which happens. So that would be the most likely scenario. If it wasn't a mistake and you didn't apologize, it'd probably be a situation where the studio just said, okay, well, you're off of our screening list. And the whole idea about these relationships with studios gets a little dicey. Here's where the journalism professor in me comes in that you never want to be beholden to the studio, in that you want to be an independent as a reviewer. You want people to believe that the views that they are getting about films are independent and not something that studios are paying you or bribing you to produce. So the goal as a critic, I would say, is to have a nice working relationship with the studios and one of mutual respect, right? One where the studios aren't going to be hammering away at you if you give a review that they don't like, and one where you're going to respect guidelines like embargoes, right? Like, I'm not going to, if they say, hey, we're going to send you this film early, but you got to give it at least 3 stars, I'm going to turn that down because, then I serve no purpose as a reviewer. Basically, I'm writing an ad for them. But if they say I'm going to give you the film and there's an embargo date, I figure, well, that doesn't fundamentally, you know, alter my opinion. And so that sounds reasonable. I'm not going to be able to see this film early any other way. And to give much credit to studios, I've worked with them for years and I've never felt pressured to give a positive or negative review. I mean, obviously they send out press materials and they're trying to put the best face on the movie and they're hoping you give it a good review, but I've never had a situation where I give a bad review and they're like, we're not working with you anymore. I've never had a situation where I've given a glowing review and it's like, oh, we're always, you know, it's, they just do what they do. The publicists at the studios I have worked with have been really stand-up people. It's like we just sort of have an agreement. We're both doing a job here, right? I'm going to report honestly. You're not going to hassle me about reporting honestly, but I will follow your rules in terms of not breaking embargoes, not, you know, I'm certainly not going to take your screeners and pirate them and upload them to the internet, because that's the thing most studios would be much more afraid of. And we have had situations where critics did that, you know, like broke that level of trust, which is sort of horrifying. So, you know, we agree not to steal their work, not to violate intellectual property rights, not to run reviews prior to them saying they're authorized, because we wouldn't even be able to see this work if it wasn't for them giving it to us early. And on the other side of it, they agree not to exert undue pressure on us, hassle us if we write things that they don't like, et cetera. And that's what you go for. And the way that you achieve this usually is just going to work for a noteworthy outlet or becoming part of a critics organization that's very trusted. In my case, I mean, I've been working with, some film publicists. I know them well enough. They know exactly who I am, even though I'm still kind of like just like a part-timer now. I've been working with these people for decades. And they trust me because I have always been upfront and honest with them. And so sometimes if I need something that's unusual in order to see a film early or to get a director, I can say, hey, you know, I know this is unusual. Will you consider it? They can't always accommodate me, but sometimes they will. And same thing, you know, if they come to me with a request that again allows me to maintain my independence, you know, I'll work with them. So it's just sort of it's a matter of trust, right? The studio reps over time develop a trust in you and vice versa. And again, the main thing for me is it's trust, but it's always got to be based on independence as well, right? There can never be a situation where the studio believes it has any amount of control over what I write or what I produce in a broadcast, because that would, you know, pretty much make me worthless as a critic. At that point, I would just be a propagandist or an advertiser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. It's interesting to learn about it. It's like how embargo, like, you know, it's the first time I've heard the term, and it's pretty much a fancy word for gentleman's agreement. And, and it's just, it really goes to show just as they do, renting out an entire theater just for one critic, all this effort that they go through with embargoes and whatnot, it really just goes to show how much influence film critics really have on audiences. And, it definitely makes me look forward to becoming a film critic. Like, I just want to have a stamp on the world and feel like I, you know, like I'm being noticed. And it seems to be the case with film critics.
And to be fair, I will say what I've noticed with studios over the years is studios care much more about how you feel about a film when you're voting in a rather noteworthy organization. Like, I've been a member of the Broadcast Film Critics Association for many years, and I, under normal times here in Chico, I give reviews, broadcast reviews for Action News Now, which is a local TV station. I actually haven't done any since the pandemic kicked in, because this has been theaters have been mostly closed. It's been super weird times. So who knows exactly how all that's going to play out in 2021. I guess nobody knows what's happening here. But studios are much more concerned with letting me see a film around this time of year when I'm getting ready to vote in the Broadcast Film Critics Association's Critics' Choice Awards than they are if I'm just doing a review for Action News Now or for my website or one of the print or web-based outlets that I use a lot. Highbrow Magazine, great little online magazine, runs a lot of my stuff. Studios care much more about letting me see things for awards voting than they do for my outlets. So I think their thinking is where you really have influences is when you win awards, right? Like if that Trial of the Chicago 7 ends up winning Best Picture this year, they will consider that more valuable than a four-star review from Forrest Hartman in one single publication. So the criticism does have power, but studios seem to believe, and they're probably right because they invest a lot of money in deciding how to market these things. Studios seem to believe that it's the collective critical voice that really has power, because what they really seem to care about is winning these awards, right? And so they will go to great lengths come award season to make sure that individual members have seen the films that they're pushing for awards, even though they know we only have one vote, right? And I think Broadcast Film Critics Association's up above 300 members now. So, you know, one vote out of 300 certainly matters, but I sometimes go, wow, you know, does my vote matter that much? Well, apparently they think it does.
Yeah, it's almost like politics when it comes to the award shows and stuff like that, you know, pressuring people to be like, hey, give our movie the little nudge there.
Well, very much so. And I think people, when they watch award shows, need to remember that as well. It shouldn't be, right? A film award should all be about quality. But when I talk about, you know, when La La Land came out that year, they actually had me, they wanted me to see that film in a theater. So they said, hey, will you watch it in a theater if we rent it out? And I'm like, yeah, well, I guess I won't turn that down because it's the way to see it. They ended up sending me a screener eventually too. But it was very important for them that I see it on the big screen. And the reason I bring this up, because when you say it's about politics, I love La La Land, by the way. That was my favorite movie of the year when it came out. But there's many little studios that produce really great movies that they couldn't rent out the theater for 300 different critics if they wanted to, right? They just don't have the money. In fact, they might be able to do nothing more than send me an email with a screening link and hope that I watch it. And those sort of things, although I do maintain my independence, I think they have an impact that's sort of subconscious, right? It's easy to lose that screening link. It's hard to, hey, we want you to go see La La Land Tuesday at 7. We'll book it. We'll set everything up for you. It's a lot harder to forget to watch that than it is, you know, the screening link that gets mailed to you. And it doesn't mean that La La Land or whatever it is, whatever big studio film that has the money to do that is a better film. It means they've got more money to make the push. So as hard as I try to work to be independent and not care about that, like when I watch the film, I'm going to judge them the same, whether they have a ton of money behind them or not. The ability to get films in front of people's eyes with marketing muscle is just like an election, right? Just like the great candidate that nobody knows about because they got no money and they can't put any signs up. Films are sort of the same way, right? The film that can put up, you know, a vote for so-and-so on every block has a tremendous advantage over the guy who sends out emails and hopes that people, you know, even see them, that they don't go direct to people's spam filters.
Yeah, I mean, it's hopefully with the, it would almost sound like I'm an older person, but like the rise of the internet. It's like the internet's been around for a while, but hopefully it seems like that indie films with the internet, indie films are able to get more attention, that the attention that they deserve, And it's unfortunately, they just still have that disadvantage when it comes to winning the big awards like Best Pictures. But, you know, there are some festivals and stuff like that and award shows that are kind of geared towards the indie films. And it's definitely something that I am happy to see for sure. And it promotes more creative filmmaking and out-of-the-box filmmaking in general.
I think places like Netflix are evening the playing field. You know, not Netflix, of course, a big company. It's got a ton of money in that, like Trial of the Chicago 7, which I've mentioned sometimes. Ton of huge names in that. Lots of money went into that film. So, but it is possible for smaller films on some of these streaming platforms to gain pretty good traction. And I think it's because of exactly what you're talking about, the internet. Like when I talk to my college students, I haven't done a scientific poll, but I would guess at least half of them don't have access to traditional TV. They just don't watch it, but they almost all have Netflix subscriptions. You know, some of them have Hulu and things like that. So it's possible for a smallish film that gets picked up by Netflix just to get a lot of traction and start trending. And to actually get far more people seeing it on a platform like that than if they released it into theaters and would need a massive marketing campaign to convince somebody to see it, right? Because Netflix, through its algorithms and such, will recommend something to you if it thinks you like it. And so I do think I do think we're seeing an evening of the playing field with outlets like that, right? I don't know if it's really easier to get your film in front of somebody or not, but there are alternative routes that don't involve massive budgets, right? If you can get your film sold to the right person who will then sort of distribute it for you. And you know, with Netflix, their goal, of course, is just to keep eyes watching movies. So if something they paid very little for becomes the most popular thing on their platform, well, they probably love that, right? Hey, people are still watching, and this was content we didn't have to pay a fortune for.
Yeah, for sure. And this makes me think about other stuff, other routes of conversation to go, but I can't believe we've actually been talking for over an hour. I mean, for me, I love this stuff, so it just went like a breeze. But yeah, that is the questions that I had prepared. And like I said, I can continue forever, but I think that I've had you enough. I've had you long enough for today, and I'll go ahead and wrap this conversation up. So I'm not too worried about the ending being polished or anything, but you know, just want to, again, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to speak with me. And yeah, I really look forward to reading more of your reviews, hearing more of your reviews, and just getting back to watching movies in general and just trying to get out there myself and try to put a stamp on the world myself. I'm really looking forward to it, the next chapter of my life, because I am graduating after this assignment, essentially. I mean, after this semester, so.
Well, congratulations on that. That's a big accomplishment, especially in the pandemic era. I know graduating the way things are going these days is different, but congratulations, and you know, stay in touch. I look forward to following your career.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that and just for everything.
Thank you for listening to Back to the Films. Join me next time, where I'll be discussing the film that, despite being a total action flick, is considered by many to be a perennial Christmas movie, Die Hard.